quarreling. This kind of fasting will never get you anywhere with me. You humble yourselves by going through the motions of penance, bowing your heads like reeds bending in the wind. You dress in burlap and cover yourselves with ashes. Is this what you call fasting? Do you really think this will please the Lord? No. This is the kind of fasting I want. Free those who are wrongly imprisoned. Lighten the those who work for you. Let the oppressed go free and remove the chains that bind people. Share your food with the hungry and give shelter to the homeless. Give clothes to those who need them and do not hide from relatives who need your help. Then your salvation will come like the dawn and your wounds will quickly heal. Your godliness will lead you forward and the glory of the Lord will protect you from behind. Then when you call, the Lord will answer. Yes, I'm here, he will quickly reply. Remove the heavy yoke of oppression. Stop pointing your finger and spreading vicious rumors. Feed the hungry and help those in trouble. Then your light will shine out from the darkness and the darkness around you will be as bright as noon.
Good morning, everyone. Just get myself organized and get a slide. Okay, this is Isaiah. He's an old guy, as you can see. He was actually a lot younger when we started a study of Isaiah. But Christine did tell me that we're going to finish by the end of November, which will be, that'll be wonderful. Yeah. And then we're on to other stuff. When Christine asked me if I'd speak from Isaiah, what do you think my reaction was? I tell you, panic. It was panic because I didn't know you'd be here this morning. But I do want to reassure you that I've listened to every message on Isaiah with great interest. And but when you're asked to speak about chapter 58, there's this sort of question that burns. It said, what's happened in 1 to 57? And how does this all come together? And, what's the big picture here? So, for me, the big picture at the start would have been that God is talking to the people of Judah and saying, if you don't get your act together, then there's going to be trouble. That to me would be the Isaiah picture. But there needed to be more than that, obviously. And so I needed to see what came before that. I'll talk about that in a moment. But I don't know whether this is useful to you, but click. Oh, yeah, good idea. How's that? Mm-mm. Thanks, Dave. Is that it? You're just going to tell me it's on? I thought you were going to help me. Oh, thanks. orchestral pieces of music, they're complicated and they're long and there's a repetitive theme in them. And I saw Isaiah like this. It's a complicated 66 chapters of preaching, it helped me to see that it does all come together. It comes together in a way that that an orchestral piece comes together. So I don't know whether this will help you, but I'll just take you through the journey I went on. That it's in parts, and I think we probably all know this. It's in different time periods. So the first period is prophetic words that come to the people of Judah through Isaiah, and it is the turn to God or else passages that we're probably familiar with, and it's about judgment, and it's that judgment being brought into effect by other nations. So God is effectively saying to the people of Judah, you've got a lot of problems. You're a small country and there are enemies all around. But it is, unless you actually change your ways, it is going to get worse. And there are a people from the north, the Babylonians, who will come and destroy Judah and take you away. So change your ways and follow me, follow the practices that I've set out for you. Then there's another series of passages in this first part that deals with the neighbors of Judah. And it's God's judgment in relation to all in countries, and there's a number of chapters that work our way through that. So we finish that first part of Isaiah, and then we get, it's like an interlude. There's this strange piece that comes, it's a historical piece, and it's about the delivery of Jerusalem under siege from the Assyrians and Sennacherib, who is their leader. And it's this miraculous deliverance of Judah when they are under such pressure that God delivers them. And then there is another piece there, which is a little bit amusing, that in his prayer, Hezekiah, who's the king, sees that he will need to make some friends. So he decides that it's best for him to make friends with the Assyrians. And then there's an envoy arrives from Babylon. And he brings those people in as well. So he wants to be friends with everyone. And he shows this envoy from Babylon the treasury that Judah has. And Isaiah says to him, I don't actually think that was such a good idea. That doesn't really seem to be a bright thing to do. And of course, it turns out that the Babylonians will come and take all of those treasures. But that's like an interlude. And then we move forward 150 years. And so the next part of the book of Isaiah is about the people from southern Israel who are in Babylon. So we've moved now to like 530 BC. And this is God speaking to the people at that point and saying to them, you will return to Jerusalem. You have been taken into exile by the Babylonians, but there will be a time soon that you will be taken to Jerusalem. And your deliverance will come through the defeat of the Babylonians by the Persian people, by Cyrus. And it will be Cyrus who releases you to go back to Jerusalem. So be faithful and be confident that that will happen. And then this mysterious figure comes into this part of Isaiah, a mysterious figure who is a suffering servant or a Messiah that will lead the people of Judah into a longer-term future with God. Mysterious to the people of Judah because they don't have the benefit of hindsight that we have to see that that mysterious figure turns out to be Jesus. And so we see there the prophetic statements that we've come to know and come to place in our belief of these prophecies in the Old Testament about Jesus. And then we have the last section of Isaiah, which is calling this redeemed community to worship and to a proper life. So it's God saying to the people, this is the way I expect you to behave. This is the way I expect you to worship, in anticipation of return to Jerusalem and ultimately in anticipation of a new heaven and a new earth. Now, there is a bit of a mystery how Isaiah was able to prophesy 150 years in advance, which is probably for another conversation with Christine, or I'm happy to talk about it afterward, but I don't want to touch on that right now. Let's just pass on that. But Isaiah can also be seen, in addition to being seen in parts, it can be seen in themes. And so these are the key themes that I feel are in these 66 chapters, that Yahweh is the God of history. And so encouraging that Mike talked earlier about God is in control. The history of the church shows that God is in control. And we certainly need to pray that now, don't we? It's scary because in these passages in Isaiah, God is using other nations to bring great punishment on the people of Judah. Scary but encouraging for us that God is in control of history. We know that God is angry with Judah. He's angry that they worship other idols. They worship Baal. They worship Asherah. And this really is a big point for God. And there's much of Isaiah is dedicated to God's repudiation of this worship, that God demands actions and he wants the heart of his people to recognize that they must be just and righteous people. So he's got expectations of them in the way that they behave and the way that they act and worship. There is always hope for the people. There is always hope for rescue. There is always hope for redemption. And there's always a hope for restoration. So whenever God warns and whenever he punishes, it will always come with the hope of restoration of a relationship with him. But it's clear in the latter parts of Isaiah that it's only God that can work out an everlasting reconciliation. And that comes through this suffering servant, this mysterious figure that is introduced to us. And that mysterious figure will bring salvation to the people of Judah. There'll be peace and safety in that new age. So, with that in mind, where does chapter 58 fit in? Well, we're clearly in the last section, so 56 to 66. This is God setting out his expectations, his demands of the people of Judah for their return to Jerusalem. So this is him saying, this is what I expect of you. And where does it fit here in the themes? It's the demands that he has for his people, God's demands for worship and for their behavior. So this is the first 10 verses of chapter 58. So we move to the passage. I'm not going to read through the passage, but in this first part, these are verses 1 to 5. This is God effectively saying to the people, they've been in Babylon for two generations. They've become much more conscious of their worship in exile than they were when they were in Judah. And God is saying to Isaiah, they're complaining. They're complaining that they are fasting and that they are doing all that's expected in worship, but I'm not answering their prayer. And the reason I'm not answering their prayer is I just don't consider that these religious practices are what is needed for a proper relationship with me. So that's the first half of this passage. Then we move to the second half of the passage, and God is saying, what I really am looking for is justice and righteousness. And you people, you're missing both. The religious part is there, but religion in itself and religious practices are not enough for me. I am looking for justice and righteousness, the way that you respond to the needs of the poor, the oppressed, the hungry, the downtrodden. That to me is proper fasting. That is what is needed for a relationship with me. Fix this, then we can talk. Fix this, then I will listen. Now, it amazes me, and I don't know why, but it amazes me that God is so identified with people who are at rock bottom. It's just everywhere in every book of the Bible that God's keen interest, his relationship, is with people who are in difficulty and in trouble. It surprises me in a way that there is such emphasis on justice and righteousness, that justice and righteousness aren't seen by God as the product of our faith in him. They are seen as the heart of our relationship with him. It's not something that we get right because we have right beliefs. It's something that's in our heart, that justice and righteousness is a crucial element of our relationship with God. It's just so, so important to us. It's common in the words of Old Testament prophets. I'm really not sure where I should be pointing this. The back. Yeah, okay. Here's one. This is Zechariah. Now, Zechariah around in the time that the people from Judah were in exile. So this is written from around the 530, 540. And the word of the Lord came again to Zechariah. This is what the Lord Almighty said. Administer true justice, show mercy and compassion to one another. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the foreigner or the poor. Do not plot evil against each other. But they refused to pay attention. Stubbornly they turned their backs and covered their ears. They made their hearts as hard as flint and would not listen to the law or to the words of the Lord Almighty that the Lord Almighty had sent by his Spirit through the earlier prophets. So the Lord Almighty was very angry. So it's there all through that old covenant period. And if we think of the life and teaching of Jesus, it's absolutely there, isn't it? Justice and righteousness are the center of his ministry. And I've just picked out a passage that I think we might, you know, we often find uncomfortable. It's the passage of the sheep and the goats. It's teaching by Jesus to his disciples pretty well immediately before his crucifixion and resurrection. When Jesus says that in the end days, when he comes, he will judge. And when he judges, he will say to the people, when I was hungry, when Jesus was hungry, when I was naked, you gave me food and you gave me clothes. And the people say to Jesus, well, when was that? We don't remember that. And Jesus says, of course, well, when you reached out to the poor and the hungry and oppressed, you reached out to me. In the same way, he says that when you didn't reach out to those people, then you didn't reach out to me. It couldn't really be put in stronger terms. It's very strongly worded in Old Testament writings, but in the words of Jesus, it's absolutely fundamental that justice and righteousness are the center of his ministry and his teaching. So what about the relevance to us today? Equal treatment of people, refugees, people of different races, indigenous people, people with different sexual orientation, disabled people, women, particularly in many areas of the world, a just and righteous society, wealth distribution, honesty in politics, honesty in business. We don't measure up well, do we? Yesterday's Herald, there's the political editor is Peter Harcher, and his piece in the Herald yesterday started with this sentence: "It has been an excellent week for hate." It's been an excellent week for hate. If he'd been reading Isaiah, he could have written, "It's been a terrible week for justice and righteousness." And it has, isn't it? There's a sort of sadness that hangs over us. Like others have expressed this morning, I feel very sad that 3 in 5 Australians could not bring themselves to recognise Indigenous people in our Constitution and could not give them a voice, an advisory voice in their affairs. I just feel very sad about that. I can't quite understand how we have come to this point. And I can only hope, as has been expressed earlier, that this could be a turning point where there is a realization of the wrong that has existed over more than 200 years, and a desire and a willingness to put things right and to close that is a significant gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. I feel very, very sad about that. Judith said to me this morning, you know, one of the things that is really sad is that we've been with a number of our friends this week, people that we've shared a meal with, and they've got different views from us. And I can't understand that. I just find that's really difficult. Not the only thing that we've coped with this week, is it? Oh boy. I was in Israel a few years ago, and the thing that struck me was how unimportant to most people this land claim and the claim over certain historical buildings is. That the vast, vast majority of Palestinians and the vast, vast majority of Jewish people just want to get on with life, to be able to practice their religion, to live in safety, and just to be. And yet there is this conflict that in this week alone has seen 3,000 people killed, over 1,000 of them children. These are not the people for whom it's important, the land situation. These are innocent bystanders. How can this happen? How can man make decisions that brings us to this point? How can that happen? I don't understand that. Let's push this somewhere onto the back pages. It's the same thing, isn't it, in Ukraine, that some people, probably relatively few people, think it's so important that Russia has sovereignty over this territory that it's worth the lives of over 200,000 people. And it's destroyed the lives of many, many more people than that in an 18-month period. How does that happen? How? What's in the hearts and the minds of people making those decisions that causes them to make those sort of decisions and commitments? I can't understand that. Sorry, I can't understand this one either. And you may have read about this. Was it possible that people at 3M realized that there were chemicals in their products that would have adverse health effects on many people, knowing that probably all of us in this room and the vast majority of people through the world have those chemicals in our blood? Was it possible that they made decisions to continue operating that business? Well, it turns out it was. It was possible. In fact, it's likely that is what's happened. For some reason, for corporate gain or for personal gain or for whatever reason, 3M continued to produce chemicals that have got adverse impacts for all people around the world that were in products that we thought were harmless. How can people make those decisions? Well, I feel powerless, really. That's how I feel. I feel sad and I feel powerless. But I was encouraged. I think it was Nat said this morning that, you know, maybe as a church we've got the potential for more impact than we do as individuals. It was the Dalai Lama who said, if you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. And I think there's some truth in that, but it still is not all that realistic, is it, in the face of the worldwide calamities. It's just not, it's not easy to see how we can have an impact. But maybe we can. Maybe as a group of like-minded people, we can draw confidence from each other and do more, particularly with our Indigenous brothers and sisters. Maybe we can. But I do feel powerless. However, we have to hold on to that belief that God can and will act. We have to do that. Because that is what he's shown that he will do in the he's done in the past. And we have to be confident that our prayers for these big things that we feel powerless about will have an impact. We have to. And we need to continue in prayer. But if we're powerless on these bigger things, we're not powerless on our own in our own lives, are we? In terms of the way that we lead our own lives, just righteous lives, we are not powerless. We can seriously influence that. And so let's go back to this passage and see what that means. And I've just pulled out three things. The demand for equality. This is God's demand to us. Well, to the Judeans, but let's say it's to us as well. Not to turn away from our own flesh and blood. In other words, we are all brothers and sisters. We are all created in God's image. We are not better than other people. We are not worse than other people. Do away with pointing the finger, working from a position of superiority that we feel we are able to point to others and say, well, we are in a better position. Do away with that. Be serious about equality with people who feel that they are unequal. We can do that, can't we, in our daily lives? Help. Could you move me forward a slide, James? Special care for the vulnerable. Oh, it's just so prevalent in God's direction to us. Share our food with the hungry. Provide the poor wanderer, the refugee, with shelter. When you see the naked, clothe them. And this really important point, satisfy the needs of the oppressed. That's what we need to do. And another one, please, James. And this one, spend yourselves. This is not, justice and righteousness is at our heart. It's at the center of our relationship with God. Justice and righteousness is not something that makes us feel good, that we have helped somebody out. God's expecting that it will come at a personal cost to us. Spend ourselves. It's a very different thought, isn't it? This is not, you know, giving with no impact. This is giving of ourselves in a way that really shares all that we have and all that we are with other people. So let's circle back. If we do, if we're in prayer for these bigger situations that we feel powerless about, and if we live our lives with justice and righteousness, then see what God says. Then you will call and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help and he will say, here am I. Amen.